and they will report back to us on the outcome of looking at the schedules. Two is we have to discuss the DA's request that we get legal advice on Section 15 of the PFMA as it was applied in the case of the SA extension. Thirdly, we agreed to do a little statement on the SAA board chair's extension, which we need to consider an issue. So, fourthly, we have got the program as amended following yesterday's meeting. There's one outstanding matter about SARS that we will deal with in the next few days. Having said that, welcome everybody. As I remember it, we, on the 12th of September, we left off at the beginning of Chapter 8. Am I right? Who's in charge on this side? Is it you, Janine? Oh, you're right.
Yeah, of course, I'm in charge.
Yeah. So it's Section 50, right?
Yes.
Okay, right. On Section 50, Sub 1, there. Let me look at the comments very quickly. If you turn to page 44, you'll see there's nothing on Section 50 until we get to 62, right? So on 50, one, are there any comments? I read all of this last night, and so for me at least, I'm a bit more familiar with the issues than others might be, unless they also read it. But I can see nothing on 51. It's a straightforward matter, right? Who's Roy, are you going to quickly go through 51, sub 1? What is it?
Yes, Chair. My colleague Mashudu will just take us to the section.
Good. Okay. Very quickly, yeah. It's a straightforward one, I think.
Okay. So if you look at Section 51, basically it's really premised on the fact that any major change to an insurance business can actually impact upon the validity of an insurance license. So 51 is just talking about the fact that an insurer should actually get approval from the Prudential Authority before there's actually any transfer of its assets or liabilities. That's 51.
Yeah.
And 52, we talked about an insurer, and 52 is focusing
for
on
the
rights.
Similar thing for the rights. So I think we agree with that. 50 sub 3.
And then 3 is talking about, again, if you look at, you have a thick pack in front of you that references all the different, other legislation that's actually also referenced here. So,
yeah. I don't have that Thursday. When did it come this morning? Yes. As usual, yeah. Okay, fine. We don't want to vote on the vote, so we let it pass. Oh, there it is, yeah. Anyway, the chair is always the last person to get this. I would have looked at it last night if you said this beforehand.
So
can I say something, Roy, since you had a book? You had, like, from the 12th of September to now to do what happened?
No, apologies, Chair. It was quite a long document to
do it. Because I didn't have time last year.
Yeah,
I could have gone through it easier that way. You know, the chair at least has to do it. I'm not saying this is a high commentary, but I have to do it. It's my job. And it makes it faster. And if you don't do the homework, then you sit here and you get a very restless. But I don't get very restless. Funny movements and all. His face gets irritated. He outlives the justice. He's forced to live with me. Then he gets still adjusting. I don't know how long it takes.
I'm still
adjusting. You look at Frank, can you give me legal advice on that one? All right, Ron, on a more serious note, right? I mean, to be fair, it was...
Give me a lot of time to have gone through this last night.
Chair, no, we do apologize. It's unfortunately quite a long document, but I think what we just try to do is try to link all the different references in the insurance bill to the references in the.
Yeah, we asked you to do that, remember?
Yeah,
right, but that was like how many thousands of years ago.
Yeah,
fine, okay, you guys work hard, so I won't be tough, but it would have been kind to have just, maybe it's good you didn't, then I watched the TV program late last night, so I wouldn't have been able to watch that, so I shouldn't complain. Right, fine, can we move on, 50 sub 3? My friend, what's your name?
Mashudu.
We haven't seen you before, have we? You've been very quiet. We haven't, eh?
I've been here a number of times.
Yeah, but you don't say a word.
Well, today I am.
Yeah, well, why? Because you carried out, you stood your ground and you told them, hey, we're about to finish and I haven't said a word and nobody knows for me. Yeah, okay, fine, go ahead. Welcome. We like having new faces. Let me tell you, we are sick of Momo. Number one, Momo. Sick of him. Fortunately, he's gone overseas. Tell him to stay there. Number two, Roy. What he's laughing for, I do not know. Right. Go ahead.
Yeah.
But new faces we like.
Okay.
The members here are sick of me too, let me tell you. Right. Okay, I agree. Especially Mr. Hardinko, but go ahead.
Okay. So if you look at the Companies Act on the pack you just got there, the Companies Act is talking about things such as proposals to dispose of assets, proposals in relation to amalgamations and measures, and maybe even where there are arrangements between the company and the creditors. So what 3A is saying, before any of that actually happens, you need to get the approval of the Prudential Authority. And B is also about when you convert from one type of company to another, you also need to actually also get the PA's approval.
Fine, I think we agree to that.
Okay.
Any comments? No. Although it's very amusing, I must tell you, to read and anyway change the type of person it was. You mean legal person, right?
Yes.
Yeah, because Mr. Anik has been saying, I must change the type of person I am at 61. Very hard to do that. I don't know, I'm anti-Honeycomb this morning. I don't know why I'm niggling Mr. Honeycomb so much. David Mania is not here, so I've got nobody to niggle. Okay, right.
It's very fashionable now to transition, I think it was.
Yeah,
the
transition,
right,
all right.
Yes,
four,
we
come
four. So 4A to D is really the criteria that will actually be used to test whether or not approval should actually be granted in relation to what we talked about previously, so in the sections before that. 4A is talking about the fact that the PA will actually have to be satisfied that that transfer will not impede upon the financial soundness of the insurer. So that's 4A.
That's 3-4, yeah.
And then B, it relates to the fact that it should not negatively impact upon the interests of policyholders. And then C also is more about the controlling company.
Same issue, right?
Yes,
it's nice to see this, right? You constantly raise, colleagues, you know what, must be very clear. People talk about transformation, and transformation must mean in the holistic sense. It's always, Derek, you must see in this committee what happens, right? People talk about transformation only insofar, and to some extent, Momo is right, only insofar as are you creating space for new emerging entrants, primarily black, right? And that's correct. But then they forget, what about the policyholder, who's primarily, in fact, even more primarily black and particularly African and will disproportionately suffer? So we now report in transformation, you saw, we try to strike the right balances. We said yes to new entrants, but not at the expense of policyholders. And what's good about this thing, that's why this bill is transformative. In the debate in the House to tackle the EFF and the MIMIS in our own movement, I think we must stress this thing. Right, go on. It's very good, actually.
Okay.
I've kicked off everywhere. I've got PPP where you defended policyholders. Good. Yes.
The last one there is that obviously you'll have procedures that have to be complied with. So the PA will also have to be satisfied that those procedures have to.
Yeah. Anybody have any problems
with that? I'm sure not. Good. Let's move on.
Okay. And then the PA may actually, under 5A, prescribe processes that have to actually be followed, which may include processes for informing and consulting policyholders. So that's 5A.
Yeah, can I ask a question? How would they do that? It's a very interesting concept. Does that actually happen anywhere? I mean, does it really happen? You mean a policyholder, I'm at an own mutual, say. They're going to consult me. How would they do that?
So we currently also got a similar provision in the long-term and the short-term act. So when they want to transfer a book of business, there's a whole communication plan that they need to submit to us on how they're going to communicate to the policyholder, so either in via letters or SMS. And that communication plan must be audited when it's done. So they will publish in certain newspapers, they will send SMSs or letters, and that communication sort of advice of the transaction, and then there's a period of 15 days in which documents must be available for inspection for anybody at our offices or at the insurers involved in the transaction offices. And in the audit process, we would like to see how many emails did go out, how many bounced back, to see if everybody at least reasonably got notice of it.
It does happen at the moment, does it?
Yes, it does.
Yeah, but I must tell you, I'm a literate person, a master's in sociology, for what it's worth. I don't think I've ever read that letter, those letters. I can give you a sad story about the security police between the known that my insurance had collapsed with accidental insurance in 1986 and they came to detain me. The advantage of being detained was that I saved $22,000 because 10 days after I was released, I had an accident with my Mazda on the M2. It's an old Mazda, which is then I discovered stolen when I bought it. I don't want to bore you with my details. I'm very grateful to the security police. But then I discovered there were a whole lot of letters written to me, and I found another big page in the witnesses all about accidental insurance. You might know about them, the police. And I was in front of them, and the security policeman told me, you too. And then I said, what? did you ensure that accidental insurance, you know, Mr. Cutting, you probably missed that this is 1986, that's what a massive day out there on a delinquent holiday on Victoria Prison. And actually, were it not for the security policy, two misanicals, two minor episodes, small details in the underlying story, both of them are benefited. One, I ended up with a scholarship. Two, because I was rescued by the security policy, was also insured by accidental insurance. But the reason we impressed, that's why I'm chairperson. I said to him, no, I'm not insured with accidental insurance. He said, no. I said, I'm insured with Musa Ali. He said, no, Musa Ali is a broker. I didn't know what this is, broker and so on. But you know what? I found those lessons. Here I am, lecturer in sociology. Mm. I don't read that stuff.
Yeah.
So I see what you say. But quite frankly, is there nothing more that could be done? Now, Derek thinks this anecdote was meaningless. No, it's not. The question is, I have never, ever read any of those documents, nor have I bothered to look at the adverse in the paper. Mm. Now, Mr. Leeds would do that because he's an expert in this area and so on. But the average person, isn't Derek Hanley complete?
Yeah.
Very regular bedtime reading. So I'm going to ask you, so forget my bladder. The point is, I don't read it, right?
Yeah.
You think that every woman in Slumayo or Ikuvukeni or Aipal reads it?
Yeah, so the communication plan, we have changed according to the target market. So there were cases where we had a funeral book that was transferred, and we actually forced the insurer to do adverts on the radio, on the local radio station. So they need to tell us where
languages.
It is. Yes, in
different
languages.
Now, this is a big thing that's going to happen if it happens, and hopefully it doesn't. But can't I suggest, colleagues, that you put a thing in the minister must regulate, or the prudential authority must regulate, or whatever authority you think is appropriate. Antonia and Zakela just note that we would like you to consider putting in something, but you can't prescribe it here, but something about somebody regulating about the variety, in specific cases, a specific range of communication. So, for example, in this day and age, it should ideally be in 11 languages. It could not be on radio. It should also be, if possible, SMS. You know, so that it's not just the writing of those letters, because as I keep saying, even middle class people don't read that stuff. Okay, thank you very much.
Wording in 5A that sort of speaks to that, but what we could maybe do is just add something along the lines of to ensure that you know, that a broad range of stakeholders content along those lines.
Yeah, whatever you put it, fine. Good, thank you very much. Let's move on.
And then BJ is just saying that you may want to appoint a person who will have to attend the transaction or the
trust
page, actually.
Yeah, that's a useful thing, isn't it, Linda? Good. Can we move on?
Okay. And then 6 is saying that the approval that is granted by the PA will be
binding. It's binding, obviously. Yes, can we move on? Thank you,
Kevin. And 7 relates to the first registry when it comes to the...
yeah, that's straightforward, really, right? I mean, really, who's going to argue with that? Right. 8.
And then...
Fortunately, the EFF is not here, but so we can move past the 8.
8 is just saying, if it's actually attractive to have the approval, then it will be void.
Okay, 51 then, there it is, acquisition and disposal.
Yeah, so what we're also saying here is that when you do this to acquisition and disposal, you also need the approval of the...
Yeah, it's a similar thing, right?
Yes.
Can I plead with members, unless you feel strongly, or maybe we can give you more time. If we're moving too fast, please let us know. Is it fine, Derek? In that case, look, I've read this thing, right? The only question I wanted to ask you was 3B1, right? Yeah, you say here, the financial size of insurance is part of the insurance. I see what you're trying to say. Okay, I withdraw that point. So, as far as I'm concerned, that's a standard moralist thing, right? It's a logical thing to do. I've read it, but there might be a grammatical glitch here and there, but that's in the last thing others will pick up. Right, let's move on to resolution 52.1A, my friend.
Somebody else, yeah.
Will we see you again today? I mean, in the vocal sense. That's very sad. Okay, we start with you. All right. 52.180.
Janine.
Oh, Janine, please. All right, how are you, Janine?
We're not sad, Janine.
No, but you've been a lot here on the FSR board. But anyway, it's fine. We like you, so go ahead.
Thank you very much, Chair. And it's great to be here again. Thank you. So the chapter on resolution is really linking the application of existing processes that are already available, particularly in terms of the inspection of of the Financial Institution Protection of Funds Act and applying it specifically in the insurance context. And Clause 52 starts out with providing for the application of the chapter, and it particularly doesn't apply to a branch of a foreign reinsurer, a Lloyd's underwriter, or Lloyd's, but it does apply to the trust that they're required to set up in terms of Clause 41. And subclause 2 indicates when the chapter would apply in relation to those trusts, in particular if the insurer didn't submit a required plan, scheme, or strategy to address shortcomings of compliance in terms of the Act or comply with that scheme or strategy. And then subclause 3 provides that in addition to other measures that they can take, the authority could potentially act to wind up a trust in terms of Section 41, Clause 41, if the trust failed to maintain the required security that it's necessary in terms of Section 41, or submit any plan or scheme of arrangement that's required, or comply with that plan.
Can I ask you, just ask you one quick clarity. What's the scheme now? Plan we know, strategy we know, what's the scheme?
Well, a scheme, it may be like a scheme of arrangement that would be entered into when acquiring assets or disposing of assets.
Yeah.
So that
it's
has
method,
to be approved. Yeah, and it has to be formally approved. So then, a scheme of arrangement.
Is there a need for a definition in the definition section, or do you think it's unnecessary?
Well, I think that's set out in the Act. Yes.
Specifically on the financial soundness chapter, they don't like the ECR or MCR, minimum capital.
Yeah. Fine. Okay. So it's there in the Act, so the word is understood. Yeah. Sometimes we do say in another bill, scheme as defined in that section, right? If you think there's no need for it, if the members feel there's no need for it, it's fine. What do people feel? Yeah, Mr. Lee?
Mr. Chairman, when you use the term scheme of arrangement, it has negative connotations, like it's trying to get around legislation. So it might be useful to refer to where it's defined.
Yeah, we refer to the Act as defined.
Yeah.
Can we do that, please? Good. Can we move on? Thank you.
Yeah, Chair. Specific meaning in the Insolvency Act and in this bill. Because it's literally where the creditors get together and they know the guy's dying and they put together a scheme. So I remember from the bank resolution during African Bank.
It's
a scheme.
Sounds a bit cruel, but anyway, okay, fine. All the more reason we should define it, right? Okay, thanks.
And then, are there any questions? Other questions on Clause 52? Or?
Okay. No, 52 is even the whole 52.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. Then I just want to ask you something, right? The 29.4B refers to withdrawal of licenses, right?
Yes.
Right. Then what I want to ask you is, that deals with trustees, right? Section 29. All right, fine. Okay. But why have I questioned this thing? I don't know. Statutory management, appointment of a statutory manager. Right.
Yes, a statutory manager is when a person is appointed who would effectively become very involved in the management of the company in the hopes that could then cause the company to address issues of compliance or financial management that are causing issues in the insurer. And that is currently provided for in terms of Section 5A of the Financial Institution Protection of Funds Act. And so this is making it clear that can be applied in addition to insurers and controlling companies. And subclause 2 makes it clear that if a statutory manager has been appointed, they can't commence business rescue or winding up proceedings, which are more serious proceedings in relation to the insurer or controlling company, until the statutory manager is terminated.
Yeah, fine. Yeah. Okay. A question then. Yes, okay.
Just a quick one. I mean, you say it's currently provided for. So what's the change? And how often does this happen? And what's the experience of it? just for my own education.
Yeah.
Well, the purpose of this clause was just to make it clear that in respect of insurance, insurance companies and controlling companies, that existing legislation applies, because it applies currently in relation to insurers, but because we're repealing much of the existing insurance legislation and replacing it with this bill, so we're making sure that will continue to apply. Perhaps colleagues from the FSB can talk about the application of statutory managers.
So it's a bit of a new provision for us. It was only introduced in 2013 through the General Financial Services Laws Amendment Bill. That's a big one. But we've, in the insurance space, we've used it twice. And basically, it's putting somebody on the board to make sure that they actually address governance failures or financial soundness failures. So we've used it twice. And in the one instance, we've already reverted, where the board is now running the company again.
So with good results.
Yeah, it's actually quite a valuable tool.
Yeah. Can I suggest that this one you need to define in the definition section, right? It's not there. Statutory management. This precedes business rescue in space, right? But, you know, unless I missed it, there's no definition for statutory management.
So I don't think we have a definition, even in the Protection of Funds Act. It's basically just, you know, Section 5A of the Protection of Funds Act says statutory manager, and then it sort of describes what that position does. So it doesn't have a definition.
Well, in that case, will it be useless then simply to say, maybe you're right, that statutory manager, as used in this bill, refers to clause whatever of that act. But you can't define it because that act should really define it. Is that what you're saying?
You might highlight that we should have sent you this earlier, but it is on page 48 of the document.
No, that's gone now.
We do explain how that's the clause on statutory management that's in the financial information. So I think that will help.
You just have quite a lot of work for it. It takes a lot of time, doesn't it?
I agree, actually. But all the other hand of it, 6 weeks or so, right? But let's not get into that. Right, that's boring now. No, it wasn't 6 weeks, it was 4 weeks, 3 weeks. September 12th we were here last night. No, actually I'm being a bit too tough. Can I soften my irritation about it?
I paid a lot more money than you in an hour.
Okay, just for the record, that only applies to my FSB colleagues.
here we start now, a whole debate now. Forget my blabbering, 1 hour is going to get lost now. Okay, so now listen, I like what you've done, and I'll browse through it, although it's Frank's job more than mine, but let me put something to you. I accept you've done all of this, right? And I see you've done a lot of work here. But you know what? Is there no way you can still say a statutory manager refers to, what is it, section? So shall we do that? Good. The concept is good and necessary, right? So we're not disputing that. It's just the definition. Good. Thank you very much. Jenny?
That would be taken after other processes like the appointment of a statutory manager may have been attempted and were not successful in appropriately addressing the concerns in relation to the insurer or controlling company. And then subclause 1 provides that the prudential authority can apply to court for the appointment of a curator, or it could, with the agreement of the insurer or controlling company, appoint a curator, and then it wouldn't be necessary to proceed to court. And subclause 2 provides specifically in the context of insurers certain specific powers that would be relevant for insurers particularly and not necessarily in relation to all financial institutions that the curator would need to have in order to appropriately take over effectively the management of the insurer. So that, so there's quite a number of powers listed in subclause 2 that would enable the curator to act appropriately in relation to the insurer. And then subclause 3 emphasizes that the curator, when exercising all of these powers, must consider the effect both on the creditors of the company and whether they're being treated in an equitable manner, and also when acting that a reasonable probability exists that the creditor will not incur greater losses at the date of the proposed disposal of assets or transfer of assets than would have been incurred if the insurer controlling company had been wound up. So that is trying to provide some protection for creditors in the handling of the curatorship to make sure that they don't end up in a worse position than if, in fact, the company was simply wound up. And a claim of damages...
Just to highlight that all the powers that's been provided for you now is also used to align with the changes this committee made to the Banks Act last year.
I must say I read this whole
section. It was immensely boring, but, you know, there was nothing I could see here. Nothing I could see here that even Mr. Floyd Chivambu would challenge, right? Really. But anyway, go ahead. I think the other members need to be just briefed.
And
you're
fine. You're fine.
I honestly think it's fine, right? I must say to you, it's such a standard thing almost that actually I got irritated that I'd read so much. And there was nothing I could find. And anyway, I'm not competent enough to find, frankly, as a MP. It's fine. Okay, can we move on? This is one clumsy formulation. It's a grammatical one. I'll come back to it and see. Can you just alert me, Antonia, of 2C, first two lines, right? It's a bit clumsy, but, you know, it may not be easy to rewrite. But let's come back to that. I'll offer you another formulation if I get around to it. Part 3, business rescue.
Yes. Clauses 55 and 56 provide for the application of the business rescue procedure in terms of the Companies Act in relation to insurers. And this is necessary because, you know, business rescue doesn't provide for differential specific application that may be appropriate in relation to different types of financial institutions. And so it's necessary to ensure that the process is able to be applied and applied in a manner that's appropriate and also maybe of assistance in rehabilitating insurers and controlling companies. And so the clause 55.1 makes it clear that the Chapter 6 of the Companies Act applies, and it makes it clear that the prudential authority is must be considered to be an affected person who would then be able to become a party in relation to a business rescue application, because that the business rescue procedures don't sort of really provide for the involvement of other appropriate regulators in the business rescue processes of financial institutions, and so it's necessary to ensure that the prudential authority can be aware of and involved in the business rescue process appropriately. And subclause 2 provides for how that chapter must be interpreted in relation to insurers. Yes.
Yeah.
And then clause 56 is basically talking about how the business rescue applications and resolutions must be handled in relation to insurers and controlling companies. So the prudential authority could apply for business rescue, and also if an insurer or a controlling company made an application, the authority has to be made a party of the application and be able to oppose or make representations in relation to the application. And so that ensures that the consideration of the application by the court would consider all of the appropriate interests and the regulator can make appropriate inputs into the process. And subclause 3 says that a resolution by an insurer controlling company to begin business rescue proceedings must be approved by the prudential authority, and if they don't, if the prudential authority hasn't approved, the resolution would be void. And subclause 4, the prudential authority provides that the prudential authority has to approve the appointment of a business rescue practitioner and the adoption of a business rescue plan. And then if the prudential authority does not approve a resolution for business rescue or the appointment of a business practitioner or a plan, then the authority could potentially proceed to apply for the winding up of the insurer if the situation is such that really the insurer controlling company isn't able to be appropriately rehabilitated.
Right. Any questions here? Yes, Mr. Lees.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Janine, it's just for my own clarity, there are a number of steps or processes that can be invoked, whether it's a curator or business rescue. There's no requirement that one should follow the other. They can jump to any one of these, including to the last, which we're about to go through, to winding up. Am I right? And that decision largely rests with the prudential authority. Without prudential authority, I can't go straight to winding up, or I can't go straight to business rescue.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. In that, and thank you for that clarification, Mr. Chairman. Then, what is this of some concern is that we don't provide any time limits for the prudential authority to make decisions about these things. And so in business, if it's already at the stage where you're looking at one of these options, it's on the verge of going bankrupt. And so speed is quite essential, that decisions are made quickly and action is taken quickly. And perhaps I've missed it, but I don't see any emphasis on that in there. Please correct me if I'm wrong.
So I think it's important to realize how the provisions have been constructed. It sort of relies on the course, if you look at winding up in the business rescue, it provides for reliance on the course processes. So we will be bound by the rules of course. I think for us it is also important not to have downsides. We have to move quickly. I think when we get to a point to the supervisor, is that, the few instances that we've had, we actually have to, react overnight.
Yeah.
So for us, it is also critical to act as quickly as possible to ensure that policyholders are protected. If we lapse, and the court application is launched, and we're not reacting in time, it might be that policyholders are treated exactly the same as any other creditor, etc. So I think for us, to be able to act as quickly as possible in the interest of the policyholders. I think it's difficult to build, because it's reliant on the court process, which in most of the provisions, it's really difficult to impose a time limit that will be bound by the court.
Right. So, Chair, let me just get some clarity from Honourable Lees. Do you mean the situation where the creditors apply for business rescue or where the prudential authority? Because I think you're asking, you're worried that the creditors might have a quick approval by the court.
Or by the prudential authority, because it can't move forward without prudential authority agreement, as
yes.
I read it, yeah.
So the creditors may want business rescue to be initiated as quickly as possible, but then they kind of sit on their hands.
Yeah, that's where I picked it up, that's what I was just reading now, yeah. It might not apply to the areas where there's a court intervention.
Yeah, I think Mr. Lees has a case for what I can see.
So are you going to do something about it?
Can we maybe consider and come back to see
where we can... Yeah, Ken Zakele, Frank and others note that, right? So they'll come back on that one. Okay, any other questions on 55 and 56? Can I do something quickly, right? One is, firstly, I like that you refer to policyholders in B and D, right? But what are under the space issue there in B? You'll see after reference, you can close the space, but that's a minor thing. What I want to know is, you say the reference in 55.2B, right? Have you got it, Jenny? It says here the reference to creditors must be construed as a reference also to the policyholders of the insurer. Now, aren't they the priority creditor? I mean, in other words, if you have creditors from other suppliers and so on, who takes precedence? Is there any notion of that? I would imagine the policyholder is the first and primary consideration in this regard. Why are you laughing, Roy?
Sorry, this is sort of like mentioning the war between all of us.
Oh, you'll be having debates around the same thing.
We've had a lot of
I can imagine there is,
these are things we need to debate.
Can you change the mic for the record?
Sorry, I don't know why.
Chair, so
I think we will certainly, we are certainly considering bringing forward that proposal in the next round of general law amendments when we'll introduce deposit to holder protection and policy holder. It's called depositor preference in banking law and policy holder preference in insurance law.
But why can't be here? Because this is the bill on insurance. This is the bill the insurers will read.
What
would be the problem? If that's the direction you're going, is it going to be too difficult legally and policy-wise at this stage to put something in?
So maybe if I can add, so I've been a very strong proponent
of the policyholder being the primary
So in the initial draft, which means after consultation, we had made a proposal. But I think based on the comments, we did realize, because I think depositor protection is easy because it's money in a bank account. In terms of insurance, it becomes quite complicated in terms of who do you protect? And do you protect the guy with his Ferrari,
$50 million?
So I think what we realized based on the comments is that we would rather, as part of the broader resolution reform, consider better in terms of how we protect that. Also, you've got life insurance issues, you've got property insurance issues, you've got investments, especially where government sort of initiates or promotes, like the tax-free savings accounts when you buy an insurance policy. She does not have a better protection than somebody that's got an endowment policy that's got actually a lot of money to invest. So we did realize we needed to do a little bit more work in terms of exactly, so that when we create the preference, that it's actually truly serving those policyholders that should stand in front of some other policyholders.
Can I suggest something? Firstly, I never thought I'd be saying this sort of thing, right? It shows how old I've become from my 18-year-old UDW days. But even the chap with the Ferrari, right? As much as I may personally have a disdain for that sort of consumerism, it's a free market economy, right? And he or she who owns a Ferrari, usually it's a he, also has the right to get their money back, because the people who own these insurance companies are even bigger fat cats than the Ferrari owner. So, you know, ideally I would like to say, but who cares? The ANC won't even buy what I say in this regard, because it's correct. You know, if I had my own way, let's say, I would like, you know, as a personal guy, I don't think the ANC will agree with this, right? But say something like, policyholders, particularly those who, as determined by some regulation, have an income of below this amount, become the priority consideration. Thereafter, other policyholders. But the point being that even the chap with a Ferrari has a right to get back his money compared to, let's say, some other big fat cat company that is owed some money and so on. And when you do the supplying and so on, you also take certain risks. The policyholder, you may argue, also takes a certain risk, but no, it's not the same category of risk. So when you come back, I doubt, well, let's not talk about where I'll be, but I hope that issue does arise, that firstly the Ferrari guy also should be prioritized, but then you might want to categorize the prioritization. There might be somewhere, like in a social democracy like Sweden or somewhere, where this is a provision, you know, that is allowed within a free market economy.
In terms of the research that we have done, is that most jurisdictions have a preference. But they would, for instance, exclude huge amounts of policyholders. So it would purely be in terms of the property or life, and not necessarily investments.
Oh,
and we
yeah.
felt, so I think we sort of do support the fact that policyholders should stand before other ordinary creditors. But the question is, how do you rank those creditors? And a lot of insurance companies also raise concerns in terms of, you know, what it, would that cost policies different etc., will capital be more expensive, etc.? So,
it's quite complex.
All right, to help us, right, because we don't have the technical skills either. Ultimately, it's our report, not yours, but we nothing to hide. Can you draft like a paragraph, even if it's half a page, right, for our report? We will, between Zakele, Antonia, and me, and Frank, of course, look at the thing and tweak it the way we want it, right? And then it makes it easier because instead of, you know, me crafting it, when you have the skills, it's faster if you do it. Just say that these are some of the issues. The committee, the committee's view is, I take it, well, the majority will, ANC will agree with that, certainly. The committee's view is that, you know, that policy holders should be prioritized, bearing in mind there are also other creditors. The committee also feels that some committee understands that the bill that you're going to bring will address these issues. One, while recognizing the complexity of the categories of policy holders and all that stuff that you explained, Johan, then we add something like, the committee feels that consideration needs to be given to prioritizing within the policy holders certain categories, including people who earn below a certain income, as you know, you can decide, as possibly determined by regulation. Something like that, right? But then you explain the complexities of the issue, which you can bring to bear much faster than, say, somebody like me, right? Good. So we settled, right. Then the next very quick issue is, sorry, do you want to say something, right?
No,
I'm very excited about this discussion because this is going to be one of the big things that's coming with the next bill. Because
what bill is that, by the way?
That's the resolution bill. So that's for banking resolution, which will be in the omnibus bill. Because obviously, you know, as you correctly say, you are making certain creditors will get preference. It also means that other creditors are slightly worse off, and they will. There are a lot of constitutional issues which have taken a lot of legal advice.
Yeah, yeah.
So
and
we
also,
think we're okay.
You're right.
Flag.
Okay.
You know.
Yes, Mr. Lees.
Chairman, it's somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but when I buy shares in a company, I'm investing, but there's no protection. I'm the last in the line to get my money. Yes, but that's the point that the chair was making about there's risk in all these investments. So there's a balance, really.
All right, okay, we can make mention. See, the thing why it's important to mention these things, when that bill comes, Alan's job will be to tell the people who are in this committee at the time, these things were discussed, there is a report, and it should, maybe some members still here. You know, it'll facilitate a quick, expeditious treatment of it, hopefully. Secondly, it also, why it's valuable to put in the report, it'll get inserted into the House debate, right? And then it makes us all think about these issues, how complex they are. Okay, good. So you're going to help us, Josh, and Roy, and whoever. Right, good. Now the next quick issue is, right, you basically require the Prudential Authority to be notified 14 days beforehand. Very good, right? In 56.2, Janine, Roman numeral 1, right? Because yes, the PA must have a hand in all of this, right? And again, you act in the interest of the policyholders. The thing that puzzles me, Frank, can you help with this? You see, 56.2b says, any order, right? Frank, you got it. Granted by the court where paragraph A1 has not been complied with is void. In other words, this act can nullify what a court has decided. Firstly, I've never seen a clause like this before since 1994. Secondly, surely the court should check that A1 has been complied with before it decides its verdict, or what's the word, outcome of verdict. So is this legally doable? I don't know. Your lawyers looked at it, and the state law advisor looked at it, presumably. But you know, the state law advisor also, the office there gets burdened with a whole lot of legislation, and things can pass it by. Did you get legal advice on this? Can you nullify a court decision, as mad as it might be, the court decision?
Yeah, but yeah, you're not
talking about... my friend, you're talking about a decision made by them. You're saying any order, that's an order, that's what I was looking for, order. Can a law say any order that didn't meet a certain requirement can be nullified?
Yes, because it's a procedure file. So there's a procedural flaw.
All right, it's a legal question, no matter what Floyd Shivambu might say. I don't want to debate this thing. I'm not a lawyer. What do you say, Frank? You want to say something on this, Mr. Lee? Sorry.
Just quickly, I would have thought, Mr. Chairman, that the if there was a procedure failure, then it would have to be taken on appeal. It couldn't simply just be automatically null and void, because who's going to make that decision about it being the procedure not having been followed? It needs another court to assess whether the procedure was followed or not followed. And then, of course, the court would presumably rule it null and void.
There you are. That's a useful thing to consider also, Mr. Jenkins, Advocate Jenkins.
You can have some time to look at it, I mean, but I'm surprised. I've never seen anything like that. If it's doable, fine. I don't know. But then even if it's doable, Mr. Lee might be correct. Why do you have to do it?
Yeah, I almost think we're hitting the wrong place, if I must say so, because what we want is that the action is void. The Constitution gives rights to courts to make just and equitable orders. So what we're doing now is we're saying to a court, we're going to limit your discretion to make a just and equitable order. Your whatever you decide, depending on the circumstances, your order is going to be void if that procedural thing has not been complied with. And there might be unforeseen circumstances. I think what one can consider, and I'm just saying it because I've just looked at it now, is to say that if you do not comply with A1, the action itself should be attacked rather than the court order that's been attacked. So the court can then say, look, you're, by law, whatever you've done here, cannot stand because you didn't file the right notice, but you can suspend that. For instance, why can't a court suspend an order of invalidity? The courts do it all the time to give effect to whatever unforeseen circumstances that can be there. So I'm very skeptical about limiting the discretion of a court to make a just and equitable order. But let me look at it in a bit more detail. I would agree that courts are bound by the law, and Parliament certainly can prescribe to courts how it should be how it should exercise its own judicial authority. But there's a fine line that we don't want to transgress on, and that is certain discretion that courts have to make just and equitable orders.
More than that, it's actually saying an order granted
yes.
can be nullified by an act.
Yes.
Now, the second thing is, Mr. Lee, you want to say something?
Mr. Chairman, sorry to interrupt, but it doesn't say who by. Who's going to nullify?
That's exactly my point. Decide that A1 hasn't been conformed to. You know, who's going to decide that A1 hasn't been conformed to? It's the same. Now I'm beginning to understand even more that what was in my unconscious, actually, that Mr. Lee has brought out, is who's going to decide this. See, there are three different questions as I see it, right? One, and let's not belabor the point, there's MP here, right? She's a lawyer, right? I don't know if she's worked on this bill or what, but there's, well, whoever your lawyer is, can you engage with Frank, right? It's a legal question, firstly. So the first issue is, is 56.2b legally tenable? One. If it is, do we want to have it? And the third question is, can't we have a softer version of that along the lines that Mr. Lees and Mr. Jenkins are talking about? So can we leave that for now? It's no use us sitting here and becoming lawyers, really. Can we just leave it with the lawyers and they'll come back to us? Thank you. Can we move on to anything else in this section? I just want to ask, man, you know you're going to get bored, Roy, but I just do my job, right? I am forced to do my job, really, whether I like doing these things or not. This is something I feel very strongly about because of my own experience of processing legislation. And we've been at the receiving end of it, our committees at times. People pass these bills. And they'll say, despite what's in the Municipal Systems Act, you know, we do this thing. Let me give you a quick anecdote. A certain person you know very well tried to change the Municipal Systems Bill. I'll switch this thing.
Oh, there it goes. And he called me to a hotel, the Garden Court here, nearby. And he gave me about 55 amendments on a Thursday night. I think Roy is your buddy. And said, Tuesday we are voting on a bill. We want you to change. Now, I'll tell Derek the whole story later when we go forward. But I want to tell you how mad he is. So then he couldn't get his way. He's a wonderful guy, very dogmatic. So he couldn't get his way. He'd be mad. We've been in this bill for 15 months now. It's a ginormous bill. We're not going to change now. So he said, fine. When he realized he couldn't come on Monday to study good. So on Tuesday, he informed me. He said, you will pass this bill. We'll sort you out.
in the municipal finance management bonus account. And guess what they did? Exactly that. Now, a certain Mr. Hanekom was sitting there, and he doesn't remember, this is E443, with a certain wonderful Barbara Hogan. And he didn't know because he just got fired for misbehaving from the cabinet, so he came to that committee. And he didn't know all the political substance. That official, as much as we love him, got his way. No, not at our time. So we forced the ministers to come together and we sorted them out. But we lost out on some battles because that guy is so powerful, at the last minute he also influenced the finance cabinet, even Mr. Hanekom. They come in and out of their signatures, so they didn't really know what to take it off. So we were at the receiving end, the municipal systems bill at the receiving end of the MFMA. Now, we don't do that. Our committee always used to say, so you do all this despite the provisions of the companies, and did you confer with DTI? That's the question.
No, I'll ask you, did you confer with DTI? We're just doing this thing, and then one day Minister Davies or his DG will discover, hey, there's something in this other insurance act that overrides us. Did you confer with them? Because then we went to the leader of government business, Jacob Zuma. We said to him, I had a meeting, not only me, two, three of us chairs. We took it up, by the way, with the House Chair, Jeff Deutsch, and we said, this is wrong. No committee should pass a bill where it says, despite that, unless it's either got written or verbal confirmation, that that department's officials either agreed or disagreed, in which case the arbitration has to be by the two committees concerned. In this case, Trade and Industry, Joan and myself, we big buddies, we can even sort out the phone. This is all, I'm just doing my job. Have you conferred with them? That's a deep insult, right? It's directly saying, shut up now, Eunice, I've got to go. Fine, I get the drift. Okay, my quota is done. Alan, can you control me? For the next 2 weeks, no more anecdotes and no more asides. He doesn't believe I can do that, but fine.
I'll take over then.
Yeah, okay, fine. Can you monitor me? No more. Right.
In respect of Clause 55, it's not endeavoring to override anything in the Companies Act. It's just the despite is referring to other legislation in terms of which they may be incorporated. It's making it clear the provisions in Chapter 6 of the Companies Act applies to all insurers and holding companies. So it's making sure that that process applies in relation to all of the insurers or holding companies. So we're not trying to provide any change in the procedure, or where we're just making it clear how it should apply to the insurers and controlling companies.
So also maybe just to say, so this piece of legislation significantly amends the long-term and short-term insurance act, like of all the provincial.
That's under our portfolio,
yeah,
right? I'm talking about where it affects bills that belong to other portfolios.
So all of these provisions are basically a carbon copy of what's currently in the long-term and the short-term insurance act. And it
so
was
that's there anyway.
But it will be repealed. It will go from the conduct authority to the prudential authority, these powers. And maybe just to mention, so in that General Financial Services Laws Amendment Act of 2013, we actually aligned across all the FSB legislation. So the same provisions appear in the Fairness Act.
I get the drift, but can I raise something, Roy, as the head of this team? And I think the committee members, you know, as a chair, I'm ruling on this thing. There's no need to discuss it. It's a correct thing. You bring us all your next bills. You must bring some letter or something that confirms you have conferred. Like this situation is slightly different. It's already there. With the relevant departments, please. Saves us a lot of time.
Chair, just to highlight, as you know, us and DTI are greatest of friends. But we have learned through the years that we have a long consultation process before we get to cabinet, so that neither side is surprised.
Now, I know there are some
so
new members.
The cabinet
yeah,
process
maybe.
Does.
Yeah. Good. Okay.
But
and
we also keep them in the loop. And you know, in other bills, they have come and told you that they're still.
And
we think that's fair because we do the same
thing.
Okay. The reason I say this is because yesterday you were complaining about the BEEC codes. And we finally said, hey, you're one cabinet and so on.
Yeah.
Good. So we agree. Right. The next quick thing is a policy is under 6, right? You say they're on line 2, sub 6. That's from the date on which, right? Line 6 says, insurer may not enter into any new insurance policies. By here you mean not have policies with potential policy holders.
New ones.
Yeah. Is that clear? Because policies here, insurance policies, could mean policies on insurance that the company may decide on, right? But you're saying it's clear. If you're saying it's clear, Frank, I'm fine with it. For a moment, I did read it like that, because elsewhere, you know, it's not enter into any new insurance policy. That's how they speak. Maybe that's the language you speak in the insurance industry. Because you understand what I mean? One is insurance policies that a company decides. A policy would be that on a rainy day you can't do certain things. The other is policies held by a policyholder. Do you see what I mean? Do you want to reword that or not? Yeah, can you look at that? Fine, let's, can we move on? Okay, winding up. We're on 57, colleagues. Just look at the wording, please. And let it pass if you don't think there's a need to change anything. Thank you. Bye. 57.
Thank you. So the final part of the chapter deals with winding up, and clause 57 provides that the provisions.
Just give us an overview now. Mr.
Lees may have some skills here. I must tell you, I read this, Mr. Lees. No. Of the three of us, you quite clearly the best technically. The point I want to make is, you might pick up things. Like I've read 57, 58, and 59. It was two, and up to 50. It's very technical. All I could pick up was a small spacing stuff, that sort of nibble, quibble. There's nothing I can see there, right? So, Mr. Lees, help us. Is there anything, or do you want to give a quick overview that might spark? Okay, quick overview of 57, 58, and 59, not each line.
Clause 57 is effectively trying to apply the provisions in the Companies Act relating to winding up to insurers and controlling companies, and it addresses certain specific issues to ensure that the interpretation of those provisions can be applied appropriately in relation to the insurers and insurance companies.
But it's in the Companies Act, right?
Yes.
So basically, Mr. Lees, it's in the Companies Act. We'll give you some space. We're coming back to this bill in phase two, right? We're not going to go through the whole bill, Mr. Lees, remember? We're going to ask members on pages 1 to 5, anything you picked up, pages 5 to 10. Can we mandate you to look at this, right? It's only about a page, right? Is that okay, Ms. Anikum? Really, there's nothing there I could see. And quite frankly, it's in the Companies Act, which is why I skipped it. I go through very fast. Good. Okay, let's move to the next one. Right, then we're on part 1 of chapter 10. Now, the first 61 is straightforward. Colleagues, is there anything anybody could raise on that? I can't think, right? 62 is straightforward, 63 is straightforward, 64, why have you changed 65, 60 sub 5 on page 42? Why have you changed that? And why have you removed sub 6, my brother? Why have you removed sub 6?
Which section are we on?
60, my brother, 60. Right. My friend, it's on page 42.
Oh, why would
What's your name? I've forgotten now.
Tendani.
Tendani. Yeah, yes. That's right. You've been here before.
Yes.
Yeah, Tendani. 5, why have you changed it? And 6, why have you removed? You get it? On page 42.
Oh, okay. The reason why we removed it, we moved it to section 62. And we just added necessary to achieve this objective, just to limit the purpose of lessons.
Yeah, that makes sense. Right. Yes. Any questions, Doc? Can you move on? Right. 61, please. Let's think forward. When you say anything we said there, I can't think. Right, can we move on to speak in part 2? You've made a general power function to end duty. Why have you added end duty? I think it makes sense. Right, can we move on? Okay, 62.1, my friend.
62.1, what it does, it basically just empowers the PA to take steps to ensure that the proper implementation of the bill.
Yeah, that's the standard thing, that
yes.
Does, isn't it?
Yes.
Anybody got any issues there? Okay, explain to us what you've done from sub 2 onwards, because I read that carefully, and I more or less agree, but I just want the meeting to know what you've done.
Oh, what has happened there is that on section 62.2, we have moved, it was moved from section 60.
Yes.
And then the other one was just to say we wanted to explicitly
Defy it. Because of the public hearing, colleagues,
yes.
They said, hey, we want a
right of appeal, and you said Paja, and you put it in there on the recommendation of the committee. Thank you, Tendani.
Yes.
On B, on the top of page 43. I don't know what sections 3, 3, and 4 of the promotion of Mr. Advocate Jenkins will look into that and see what it is, right? But I take it that's fine. But tell us what you're doing there, my friend. Am I going too fast?
Yes.
Yeah, slow me down. Mr. Honeycomb complains I'm not fast enough.
You're doing well. You're doing really well.
Ah, please. Can you write me a letter of recommendation? I want to be chair of this committee. All my life. Can I read the thing to Ndani and John? If you look at, yeah, I think I'm probably right, okay? But Mr. Jenkins will help and Zakela and all. You see, if you look at line 3, also give the jurist that is part, is of the insurance company that are affected. So the plural, right? Singular plural, is that the thing? So it's I think, or can you look at that as a grammatical? Is that a major issue? Yeah. Okay, can we move on to prudential standards?
Yes.
Tendali?
Yes. 3.1 just empowers the prudential authority to prescribe prudential standards on any matter permitted in the bill. And also when making, it also prescribed when making these prudential standards, the PA must then consider a number of things, and this probably includes the objective of the Act, proportionality, as well as whether or not the international regulatory and supervisory standards. But I move to 63.3?
Yeah, go ahead,
Mr. So 63.3 just says that the prudential standards will basically apply to insurers, controlling companies, and so on. And 63.4 deals with what the prudential standards may impose, basically the requirements for approval by the PA, its application to existing actions, and if it applies to existing actions, the transitional period in which the standard must be complied with. 63.5 it talks about the standards on auditing standards that applies contrary to any other regulations or act.
All right. Members, any questions? Yeah, Mr. Lee. Why is it not working?
It's when there's another one on, and mine was on earlier, so that's why Roy's wouldn't work. Mr. Chairman, in terms of 63 subsection 3, that a prudential standard may. Why is it may and not must?
Where is it under 63.3?
Yes, the first.
I know this is such an old question.
Yeah, in many respects. Yeah, I know it's very difficult. I can't address them as well. Why? Okay, I don't want to speak for them. Go ahead, Tendani. Why is it may rather than must?
I think it's just an empowering provision, so it's not that we in all instances
yes.
would want to empower.
Yeah, I remember now how you reply.
So it depends on
that's right, the circumstances. Okay, I remember now. Yeah, Mr. Lee, that's the standard.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman.
That's around policy
matters.
In other words, go ahead, please.
No, that so who then? I mean. I understand what you're saying, so it might not be relevant to a particular institution, but relevant to some. Yeah. So it's in some it must, and others it must not. But it's not a discretionary thing. That's I think the point I'm trying to make. It's not at someone's discretion. It's where they're relevant, they must apply. Where they're not relevant, they mustn't apply.
I'm not saying you shouldn't raise it, because actually I find it challenging also after all these years. It's very difficult, and I keep raising it too. But what I'm saying is that he's right, actually. Those are the issues. But there's no way out is what I know. But you are right. You know what we did do one day? In the Municipal Structures Act, just to tell you, we then just divided it and we said the following must apply and the following may apply depending on the circumstances. Then we put in the minister's regulations, he must specify the circumstances not to allow for latitude. Why? Because it's national legislation dealing with local government. And Selga used to sit here, just like, you know, you guys from, what's this, Saia and all sit here now in the Chonsville. Selga used to sit here. Every what you call clause, we had to fight with Thabo Makwena and Colin Machila, right? They would sit there and they would pop more than the MPs. So they used to fight us. So we would, that's how we did it. May, there are some categories must, you know, we'll take like A and B and make it must. May, and then May under certain circumstances, we didn't say the minister can't, he must regulate. Those regulations must come to Parliament, they must be gazetted, and Selga must have a say. That's how we resolved it there. So this issue, Mr. Lees, there is no simple answer to. We will continue to raise for another 100 years. So in this regard, he may be right. So let's be careful. Don't relent. Let's hear Joanne.
So I think it's basically empowering. For instance, if we look at, say, a prudential service may apply to be limited in application to a particular kind or type of insurer. So if we have linked insurers, we would want to have specific requirements for them because the type of business that they do is so significantly different from a a disability insurer.
If I'm correct, I think
it's around this in the SSRA book. And then, which then applies here, which says that, you know, the prudential standard may apply to the insurer. You kind of then think, if it applies to the insurer must obey the prudential. It's kind of, you know, that's sort of what you putting your finger on. You know. I think we have that clause, that,
right,
that the insurer must comply with the prudential standard, which does apply.
Yeah.
Right.
Lisa, are you okay?
Yeah.
Good. Can I ask something here? On 63B, right, you say, sorry.
International regulatory and supervisory standards must be applied, right, to the extent practicable and with due considerations to the South African context. Can I suggest, because of our preoccupation of transformation, are you listening, Roy? Because this is quite an important one. I don't know whether it's doable, right? Instead of saying under 63.2B, Momo will have a heart attack, so you'll have to confer with him in Germany or wherever he is. B, international regulatory and supervisory standards to the extent practicable and with due consideration to the South African context. Maybe it's too generic. Why can't you say, and with due consideration to the needs, to the South African context, you can add, but due consideration to the need for transformation of the financial sector. Because I think this is too generic.
And actually, we will have to confer with Momo on it, but we can certainly...
Yeah, but we decide.
We can certainly...
yeah, we decide.
Wording,
yeah, we can hear his argument, but we will decide.
Yeah. We will certainly look at wording.
Well, maybe they could just explain what do they mean by the South African context.
Yeah, so...
What do you mean?
This clause appears also in the FSRA, and it actually talks directly to the issue, right? So so let's take, for example, Basel III. So Basel III is an international regulatory standard. When we implemented it, we didn't implement it word for word. We amended some parts of it because it just simply didn't work in South Africa. And some of those reasons are because we're trying to develop new transformed insurers and banks, and some of the reasons are just because of the nature of the African system. So context includes, I think, already transformation. It includes
why can't we just add including, comma, the transformation of the financial sector?
Yeah.
So it covers you.
Yeah.
But on that one, you lost the battle already yesterday, right?
Yeah.
And I'm obliged to as a chair of the committee, to insist on this. Unless we can open up the discussion.
Including work well.
Including, good. Right. Can we move on then?
If you look at the next section, which is the exemption section.
No, I know you're going
to
say that.
If I can use the same words where they say for developmental financial inclusion and conservation.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. I'm coming to that. Yeah, but good. That's helpful. Good. Eric? Right. Next one is 64, right? Right,
yeah.
So this one, 64, do you want to say anything to that?
Yeah, basically what 64 does, it just requires the PA to publish on a regular basis updates on their website, on amongst other things.
It's a straightforward one, correct?
Yeah, it is.
Let's pick it up. The determination of another jurisdiction is a bit difficult for me to understand.
What are you saying here exactly? Forget the wording. Why is this?
I think this one applies to mainly to licensing of foreign branches and of reinsurers. So basically what it says is if the insurer is based in the UK, for example, and they want to open a branch here, their regulations there must be equivalent. The PA has the powers to determine if whether or not their regulation is equivalent to our own regulatory framework.
Yeah, but the
question I want to ask you very quickly, if it's a UK company, those regulations can't transcend ours, surely. Right. So there's nothing here about where there is a conflict or a divergence even, that our requirements prevail over the UK ones.
But that's exactly the main reason for this process, to say the PA has the discretion to make that decision of whether or not to be able to address that issue.
Why, Tendani, can't we put a clause in where there is a divergence or inconsistency or conflict between ours and theirs, that ours prevail? Presumably in their jurisdiction they say the same thing, that if a South African company is there, Old Mutual, that they will consider our regulations, and fine, if it's consistent with theirs, but where there's a conflict or difference or whatever, theirs will prevail in the case of a South African insurer that's based there. Can we do that?
So I don't think there's a need, my sense there wouldn't be a need for it, because the purpose of that section is basically to say that because the basis for our prudential framework is Solvency II adjusted to meet South African circumstances, but then for our insurers to trade elsewhere, they will want to look at our regulatory framework and say, well, it's consistent, so they pose little risks to our system, and that we can sometimes rely on decisions made by that supervisor.
Or do it anyway in the process of acknowledging their
right
yes.
to do business here.
Yes.
All
so
right, fine, I'm not happy,
thing.
But look, I won't fight this, unless the other members feel strongly about it. Neither of them seems to. Mm-hmm. Can we move on? Okay, exemption. Now, this is an important one, colleagues, because this is partly a reflection of the committee's views. I know Mr. Haneko may not have been here at the time, but we wanted some sort of leeway latitude without affecting deposit holders on providing some sort of exemption to encourage new entrants, right, Tendani?
Yes, that basically was the main purpose of this act, basically just to give the prudential authorities the power to exempt, and I think it does to exempt a certain insurer with a certain conditions.
Yeah, okay. Is there any question? Can members look at this carefully, Derek? And so on, the ANC pushed for this quite a lot, the EFF to a lesser extent. Well, yeah, EFF too. So we would like to come back on this, but for now I think it's fine. Only one question I have, Tendani. Under 2, you say, any exemption may apply to, right?
Yeah.
And then you say limited application, particular kinds, right, Tendani?
Yeah.
Types?
Yes.
Which may be defined either in relation to a category, kind, size, or in any other manner. Now, in any other manner could cover me, but are we not saying, shouldn't we have either in relation to category, kind, size? And what I would like to put crudely, you can't do it, right? But just think of a way out. Maybe Frank's gone out, but he can suggest a wording. What we want to communicate clearly is when you're talking of category, kind, size, it could apply even in the apartheid era, right? I mean, we also had clause, categories, kinds, and types. What we are saying also is black insurers, actually, new entrants. So something about previously excluded, or I don't know what, previously disadvantaged, or some wording that suggests they too are a category for which you're providing exemption without, we keep saying, affecting the policyholders. Mr. Hanekom, can you help here?
No, your last sentence kind of covers me. I think the 661D says will not conflict with the public interest, but I think it might be more specific, that more along the lines of what you're saying. I wouldn't say frustrate the achievement, I would suggest
undermine.
Yeah.
But I like the word frustrate personally, but undermine. No, but frustrate has a certain connotation from Momo's side. Let's make it undermine. Because it's Momo, I don't trust the word frustrate. You can tell him I said so. Undermine.
Can you
or some other appropriate word. Frank can help us with the Zakele. Yes, Tendani?
Chair, can you also maybe look at 66.1C, where we talk about for developmental financial inclusion.
I saw that my brother had ticked it off.
So
it warmed my heart.
It wouldn't address your
concern. No, I have ticked it off. Look.
Yeah, if you don't believe me, late last night.
Okay.
But the point is, that's not enough. Then I also raised here, you see. So, can you find some category? I know it spoils the English language there, but think of something, please. Man, can we... is Zakele here? Making notes, right?
Yeah.
He's here, okay. And, right, okay, so amendment there. All right, unless you can prove to us, like Momo's likely to, that it's unnecessary, it's clumsy, you know, and so on. Let's put it there, please.
Yeah.
Let's just put it there. Okay, thank you. On unlicensed insurance business, I don't know, Mr. Lee, this is your area. I can see nothing there on 67, my friend.
Sorry, Chair,
yeah.
Just before we go on,
yeah.
Some character on 66.1D. I mean, just in relation to Honorable Honokum's question, I think we must make it very clear that it shouldn't prejudice or affect policyholders in any way. You don't want a situation where someone can apply and then the exemption might hurt policy. I know it's one of the objects of the Act.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah, in fact, it's a
we
very strong
that
point.
Yeah, I just want to clarify because we'll put that in.
No,
yeah.
It's good, yeah. No, we're agreeing with that. So there's two amendments. Sorry, I should have said two amendments in this section, right? Okay. All right, the next way is straightforward, colleagues. I mean, unless you want to raise this, this is like Brandon Alfie type intervention. There's nothing there. It's straightforward. Can I suggest we skip 67? It's done. 68 and 69. The only issue in 69, colleagues, Sendani, in 68 there, is penalties now. It may not exceed 5,000 rand. Now, Mr. Lee, do you know anything about this? I can't tell whether that's correct. 68C. Sendani, help us just explain what 68C says on page 45.
It's for every day.
It's a lot of money. Good.
Good. A lot of money, we agree. Right, that's a very useful criteria to use. If the DA thinks a lot of money, it's very good. Not enough. Sorry? Yeah, good. Okay, we agree. Right, next one, 69 offences now. Yeah, I was a bit not sure. Mr. Lees, what do you think? Let's use the barometer to decide our own ANC position, right? So you might not want to say anything, but 69 sub 2. I can tell you a little tale about sad sack, Eric, I won't. You're missing out because you want to go home 2 minutes earlier. I will sort you out in the study group. Right, Alf, what do you think about 10 million, please, so we can decide ANC positions on this?
Mr. Chairman, you know, it's not a stipulated 10 million. It's up to a maximum.
Not exceeding.
And so, in that sense, it really depends on who's going to set up the table. Of fines and how that is done, because I mean, quite unfair to try and impose a 10 million rand fine on an emerging.
Yeah, obviously.
And but at the same time,
it's going to be a table. Yeah.
Yeah, that's where you actually assess the.
The specific. Yeah. Fine. No, I understand.
I think as it stands, 10 million to Old Mutual or Sanlam would be a drop in the ocean, really.
That's what I was thinking. That's
yeah.
My point. Even Mr. Lee is saying it.
Well, I don't mean due respect. The DA is saying it's not about him personally. What I'm saying is, I must say, Derek, I wasn't impressed with 10 million, given the amount that these people make. Is it commensurate proportionately with what happens in other jurisdictions, other such bills and so on, or acts?
It's a little
late.
If I can maybe just position the clause. So the clause only deals with contraventions where we don't have other remedies. If you're an insurer,
yeah,
we can issue a directive, we can stop you from doing business, we can take your license, and we can impose administrative penalties under the Financial Sector Regulation Act, which is unlimited. But here it's important to look at the sections that we're referring to. That, for instance, when you are doing business and you're not licensed, so I can't touch you in any way, or if you're an auditor and you refuse to raise certain issues that you should be raising with us. So these are very limited number of offences that we've created here, and it's only we wouldn't have another remedy. So the 10 million, et cetera, wouldn't apply to the insurance company. It will apply so the auditor or a shareholder, et cetera, because the powers that you've given us under the Financial Sector Regulation Act are the ones that we will take to deal with financial institutions. That's already within our regulatory needs. So these are only limited to those instances where we can't touch it through the SSRA empowered provision.
Responses from colleagues?
Mr. Chairman, just some clarity. As I read it, it seems to be imposed on a person as opposed to an entity, am I right? So then the 10 million perhaps is not so small. Am I reading it wrongly?
So it could be on an audit, but it also could be
it's
a
legal title, isn't it?
It could be a legal title.
Let's get clarity. Are you talking about a legal person or an individual?
Both.
That's what I would imagine, yeah. And I think it's good. The process is okay. Our view of the majority in our financial
sector transformation for the bank collusion, not just the banks that get involved, the individuals must be sorted out. And we said the same on this KPMG story. Okay. So in other words, I think you're right, but 10 million for a company seems to me very, very minimal. Eh? Even though I hear you, but look, I don't have a strong support here. But then how many people are here to support or oppose? There's only two people. Can we leave this in abeyance for now? Let people do some work. Zakhele, can you do some work on this thing from our side? I know you've got a million things to do, but you've got enough time. We're not coming back to this for another 2 weeks at least. So can we think about this? For now, we agree. Is that correct? For now, we're fine with it. We may review it, right? So possible amendment. We're not saying an amendment. General provisions under 6910 Dani. We're quite fine with that. Unless Mr. Lee or anybody else. It's straightforward, right? There's nothing there. On 71 now, there you just added something, right? You removed on the top there from requirement. Why did you remove that on the top and why did you add? Oh, that's straightforward why you added it, but maybe you want to explain because it's an amendment. 71 now, my friend, on page 46.
Oh, that's your area?
Yes.
Oh, John,
on 71, why we deleted it from the reading was because of the addition of subsection 2. And the addition of subsection 2 is... you'll remember when we spoke about state-owned insurers previously, we said that state-owned insurers should be subject to
Good. Okay. Is anyone else to raise anything? Because we had discussed this, right? Or it was raised in our presence, as I remember. Right. So on 71, is there any issue, colleagues? Nope. Okay. Why did you... 72 is fine. What about 70? The 72 that you removed? What? Why do you remove that one that's deleted in red? Delays and exemptions, because you covered exemptions earlier.
Yes, so the delays we added to Schedule 3 on the transition.
All right, so you've done that there. So fine, now we hand over to Derek Honeycomb. I know he's desperate to sit here, ambitious as he is, but I think it's taking too long. So can you sit there as the chair now, and I'm now going to put my hand up and say, Comrade Chair.
Derek's chairing this section.
You've got to deal with regulations.
good luck.
Let's ask the people who were with us. It's a very short report. We made very few amendments, but we went through it very thoroughly.
If you could kindly speak into the mic, yes. Yeah, go for it.
We meet with the subcommittee, or the subcommittee meet with us. Can't you name that? 27th of September. And we went through all of the schedules. So on each of the schedules in the report, it also said that on Schedule 1, the Treasury and the FSB proposed additional amendments to the version we tabled with the committee on the 10th of May. And the subcommittee looked at that and felt comfortable with the proposals we've made, but they did make a recommendation that we should publish it on both the Treasury and the FSB websites for a period of 10 days, just inviting additional public comments, highlighting specifically those areas that we've added. And in most of the issues that we've added on Schedule 1 was basically as we are going through a conduct of business reform with policyholder protection rules and regulations, that we've realized there were some shortcomings where the authority actually needed empowering provisions to be imposing certain limitations.
Derek
is chairing. Yeah.
I'll double
interject,
and that honourable member down there.
Oh, yes,
honourable
member. I would like to now, Comrade Chair, thank you for kindly. I would now like to speak for 22 minutes 14 seconds as a member of the ANC study group, did the one who walks out when she doesn't get here. So now can we start on Schedule 1? I'm now going to harass them. I want that person to chair. Then I'm going to sit there and harass her. But
can we just note, please, in the minutes that I'm entitled 22 minutes. Being kind to Derek, he's rushing somewhere.
I will. Left,
can I make a confession? I haven't read the schedules, right? Which is a crime for a chairperson. I agree, but you know, you people had discussed it and so on, and I will do my job. So when before meeting in 2 weeks' time, I will go through the schedules. As much as I'll get immensely bored, chairperson, I will do it. It's my job.
But you had a very competent subcommittee there, you know.
Yeah, I
know. Two extremely knowledgeable people.
Well, one I can certainly say is extremely knowledgeable. And he's not yet.
That's fine.
Okay, I'm going to join the chairman. He'll kick me out of the meeting.
Very mean, but true.
Look at him, please. He's the chair.
So schedule 2 was also presented, and there were no additional amendments proposed from the FSB or the Treasury. It was two small ones that was already in the 10th May version, giving effect to public comment. So there wasn't a recommendation that we needed to publish that one again for comment. Schedule 3, based on the public comments and a number of engagements with insurers, both emerging and established ones, there was a concern with just how we phrased Schedule 3, which is transitional provisions, and it's how we get the existing insurers into the new framework. And how we had phrased it before was to say it's a re-licensing process, but that the intention has always been that we would convert the registration to a license in respect of all the business that they currently perform. So, to alleviate some of the concerns that was raised, that it, you know, might amount to a deprivation of property or not, we've proposed quite a few amendments to item 6 of that schedule to address that issue. So there's still a process. It's quite a detailed provision to say how the conversion of registration to licensing will happen, and because of those new proposals, the subcommittee also recommended that we publish on the website again for 10 days. And the subcommittee had also proposed 3 small amendments for us to add to the schedule when we publish it again for comments for 10 days.
And they're the tiniest of them. Yeah, just on the one thing that I highlighted, obviously another concern was from particularly the emerging insurers was that, you know, it might become an incredibly onerous process to relicense. So those clauses now very much change the default, which is the default is now the conversion will take place. They basically have to prove why they're not converting rather than the other way around.
So we don't
convert it.
Okay, thank you very much to come to Derek and Brandon and the and not one anecdote. That's brilliant. Okay, so basically we more or less done. The issues that are outstanding are transformation, right? Now, one of the things that Floyd raised, which I think he's right about, we need to apply our mind, Derek. He said that when you issue licenses, there must be 3 categories. If I remember correctly, I've got it here somewhere in my notes, right? So that's one of the issues. Let me do some work on this to save time, not today. Secondly, I think we need to take into account that we need, Roy, can you signal to Momo? It's better he gets into the terrain now rather than fight us on this side. I understand where he's at. By the way, I think some of us in the ANC are very understanding. Oh, and it's good he must stick his heels in. Because we must not be populist. But on the other hand, you know, even whether as individuals, you know, some of us have reservations about some of the things that we're going to be doing, we have to take account of where people are out there. If we don't do some of these things now and implement them, Joanne and the rest of you colleagues, 2 years down the road, nobody's going to give us a choice about it. They're going to be marching on all of our homes. So, you know, it's not because we think rationally it's the correct thing to do in terms of policy in legislation, but what's rational about it is recognizing out there the enormous frustration, right?
And there's no like light at the end of the tunnel with 0.5% growth rates. Even if you look at the sugar beverages tax, you guys are admitting about 2,000 jobs are going to go. 41,000 jobs in the last quarter. So I know as technocrats, you feel very irritated with us. And if I was in your shoes, I would as well. But just take into account the political context we're in. If we don't manage this transformation properly from here, from Parliament, where else, right, and the executive, it's going to explode in all our faces. Even the EFF's faces. Don't think they're going to forget that the EFF are also fat cats like the rest of us in this Parliament. So I want to take this opportunity. There's very little work left to be done. But on the issue of licensing, even a gentle provision, right, about licensing being linked to transformation, in a way that won't frighten off the markets and so on. It can be done. Okay. So you're working on that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I think we just want to start by showing you what, you know, I think we were maybe surprised how similar some of Honorable Shivamba's thoughts were to ours. Which
oh, but why was your boss fighting like that?
I don't think it was fighting.
Okay, fine.
But I'd just like to take the committee.
Remember, we don't have more members here, and we need to.
Yeah.
So Tandi is crucial. And some of the other ANC members, but we also need Mr. Mania here, whatever we might think of him, but he has to be the leader of their party. And we need Floyd, whatever we might think of him. So don't go through the whole thing, but just signal what you're doing, and can you send us the thing on a separate... Think about it, there's no hurry, we're only meeting in 2 weeks' time.
Yes.
But about now, we must have it a week before, right? Because now we're going to vote on the bill shortly. So, can you give us all your put the whole thing, including the ones you got here. So we avoid people being populist. And can we stress the thing that many of us in ANC feel? You're defending policyholders. You will see everywhere in the transformation report we say yes to new entrants, provided.
Right.
But on the other hand, don't use the thing about policyholders and your defense of it to avoid new entrants coming in, so the right balance. So in short, please put everything you've got that you will consider transformation in the holistic sense that even your boss speaks about.
Right.
So all these policyholder defense, Derek and I agree. That depends on the poll. Put that there. Give it to us. It'll run into about 4 pages.
Yes. Chair, if we go to page 20 of the bill...
You're going to do it quickly now.
Very quickly. I just want to signal what we've got.
Page 20 of the bill, yes?
So if you go to... it's the little C. It's quite far up the page. A little C, and then the third one, little C, Roman numeral 3.
Yeah.
The new, what's in there is now. So what the thinking is from, you know, thinking about what Honorable Shivamba had proposed, and what we think about, you know, is to what extent can we create a system where actually the licensing authority ensures that there's a plan for meeting the transformation objectives, and what we might do is link this more closely, as he proposed, to the actual charter. So to say that, you know, the insurer must start demonstrating to the regulator that they have a plan in place to meet the charter. I mean, as you know, Moment's position is that, you know, we mustn't confuse multiple objectives. So, you know, the health and safety one is actually a really good example that was raised yesterday. But there really is nothing to stop our regulators from checking that the company is meeting its health and safety requirements, even though it's not necessarily its mandate. So similarly, it could check that the transformation plan has been implemented. Because this is really a question about sustainability of the business. So that's kind of what we're signaling to think about. I don't know if members have any thoughts on that.
It has a plan to meet its stated commitments in terms of the transformation. Where would these commitments have been stated?
In actual fact, what we think about changing that now is actually to meet its charter obligations. Because that basically is, I think from the discussion yesterday...
Quite helpful. Very helpful.
No. You know what? Can you leave Momo there in Germany for longer? Let him meet Angela Merkel and so on. Keep him there. Yeah. No, I think that's very good. What else are you thinking of?
We have a schedule of things to do, which we'll circulate to you.
All right, just circulate to us. Members, do you want to discuss it now? Rather, we have a bigger meeting, so everybody gets carried, right?
There is one issue which I just want to raise now, is in the report from the committee, you had a broader definition of transformation than is currently defined, I think, in the Black Economic Empowerment Act. And we think, you know, I think in terms of the conversation about transformation versus transformativeness, We really like the broader definition. So we're just wondering if we should include that broader definition rather than
please,
narrow.
Please, please. Yeah. All right, so can you do all of that work? But please, can we have it at least a Thursday before the week we look at that? Samuel sent you the program. We just adjusted the program. I think you made some copies, haven't you? Yeah, Alan can give you a copy of the program. But we want to vote on the bill now.
Right.
The whole issue now is transformation, then a quick phase two thing, which is we're going to go, Mr. Lees, like take page 1 to 5, any new things. We're not going through it clause by clause. Frank will have checked all the amendments you've made today, right? Not that there have been many. And Frank will okay it. So I think not even the Thursday, to be fair to Frank, the Tuesday before the week. Please, let's get it done, right?
The thing has
been stuck with us for 2 years for a variety of reasons, which are perfectly understandable. Can we move on then to raise one final thing? Can Frank and Zakhele do a draft of a report, right? Members who want to add to the report, I would, without patronizing Mr. Lees, if you want to submit stuff, it's fine. We will tweak it and say we disagree or something, but it's useful to get some technically sound report, and you are better than some of us are, you and Brandon in particular. So if you've got any comments, can you submit it by what's today? Thursday. By, let's say, next week, Wednesday. Any paragraph you want to put in, right? Okay, so that said, I want to take this opportunity to thank you very warmly for all the hard work you do. We will, of course, thank you at the end. I know it's a lot of work. I know, for example, you must have taken hours to do this, right? But this is very good stuff. Ideally, you should bring it at the beginning of a bill, but we really do appreciate it, right? Nevertheless, never mind what we say, including me and so on, and I get irate and so on, which Derek is trying to control me around, then we'll fail. But the truth is, I am very, and I say for myself, because as a chair, you make my life very much easier. And for the committee as a whole, I'm sure we all agree, including Mr. Shivambu, grudgingly maybe, you work very hard, right? And we value your work. And we really think that, you know, you're an excellent team. And now only I can speak. I've chaired 5 committees. I always tell people, even Justice I chaired, right, which is regarded as the best team. You're the best team. I disagree with you more than I've disagreed with any other set of officials, but you're the best. I always tell Praveen, I told Nene, and I told Malusi this, I mean the Minister Kikaba, that you've got a very good team. So we thank you very much. You know we are very stressed because of what's happening in the political sphere, and we really think that you stay in, and even Zakhele and so on. I know in Parliament people are extremely stressed here. Derek, you know I have to interact with my job. In Parliament also, people are extremely stressed. A lot of good people. I'm just telling you my life very quickly. In the last 6 months, 3 people wanted to leave. All 3 of them are very good. Sometimes I teasingly say, and I'm seriously, the people who are around, with due respect to Ellen and so on and Antonia, most of them are here because they're floating. Those who really work hard and those who want to deliver are immensely frustrated with how Parliament is managed, but also how politicians behave. You will get a staff member right. That is why in our committee we never do this, Ask Antonia. Antonia will sit through the night and prepare a research report of 8 pages. Then the committee, nobody read it. Nobody wouldn't bother. That's why I went yesterday to Antonia and said, hey, on this report of National Treasury on Tuesday, do you want to speak to it? She said, well, all my issues are covered. It's wrong. People work damn hard that do. Many float. So really, I want to tell you, never mind our political differences. And it's very good you dig your heels in. That's what officials are supposed to do. We hate it when officials work. So once again, I'm making a long speech, I know, but I know I'm the one that benefits the most from the quality of the work you do. Thank you very, very much. Okay, now let's look at the SAA. Now, Mr. Jenkins, Advocate Jenkins, you can leave, obviously. Advocate Jenkins, you have, except the lawyers from Treasury are here, right? So, Advocate Jenkins, you did you do a written one on the SAA Section 16, PFMA, sorry.
No, Chair, I'd like to explain one.
All right, fine.
Cheers.
Okay.
I'm just taking the chair. What I have.
What's important?
That's my Linda.
Yeah.
My Linda.
Oh, you can't see.
You're saying, right? You're going to fight for a moment. You're more with it. GDG.
Yes, Chair. So what I have is the letter from Mr. Lees and a media statement from SAA. Section 16 of the PFMA specifically requires that there's a report to Parliament. That report has not been submitted yet, because I don't think National Treasury is out of time yet. But we'll only know really when we get the report. 14 days. But the report must say when they have actually done the transfer, the reasons for it, and that reasons must then comply with Section 16. What I can say at this stage is that it appears that the concern in the letter of Mr. Lees, and I speak under correction, is that this was not unexpected transfer of money. But Section 16 doesn't speak of unexpected. It speaks of exceptional circumstances.
Yeah.
Mm. So there's a difference which one must keep in mind. And I think it's a critical difference. What we have, I'm not sure if the committee was aware of it, but there was previously on 20 July this year, reports submitted to the Speaker and the Chairperson of the NA and the NCOP respectively on amounts that is also transferred to South African Airways, well, directly to the Standard Chartered Bank, for the same purpose. And that report we have here, and it's quite, goes in detail how it complies with Section 16 or not comply with Section 16 for that matter. So this is what actually would inform a legal opinion, Chair, and I don't want to go out on a limb and just say it is or is not. There's another reason, well, two reasons, and one I don't really need to deal with. But the other reason is when we look at Section 16, this report not only goes to the Parliament, but it also goes to the Auditor General. So one must ask oneself, why does it go to the Auditor General? Now, I've consulted with my colleague in National Treasury, Advocate van Schoor, and apparently the Auditor General has already indicated that they will look specifically at this previous report from July, 20 July. So one must, in terms of Section or Chapter 3 of the Constitution, not necessarily do the Auditor General's job. The Auditor General is specifically empowered by Parliament in an act to make findings whether the expenditure complies with legislation, whether it's regular or irregular. So I would say one mustn't just jump up and down and get excited, if I can use that, and then do something which the Auditor General might have a different opinion on. So there must be coherence. And these are constitutional principles. This is not my idea. These are constitutional principles that there must be coherence within government. So we need to also see what the AG is doing. And the last one is a parliamentary matter, Chairperson, which is, I've gone through what we know as the ATC's announcement tabling committee reports. I'm trying to find where this previous report has been referred to. Was it to this committee? I'm not aware of that. I'm not finding that it was referred to the Appropriations Committee of the two houses. I would be surprised if it hasn't been referred, because it should have been referred. I mean, Section 16 is clear that it must be tabled in Parliament and be made public. The Minister certainly submitted his report in July, but whether it's been tabled, I need to ascertain that. I've tried to phone Neil Bell. I think there's a few of my colleagues are on leave. We've migrated to a new emailing system, so a lot of my ATCs have disappeared, and there's been changes also where they store these things online. So I couldn't check all of them. Don't take my word for it that it hasn't been referred. I think it should have been, but I must find out where. The relevance of that is, does it fall within this committee's mandate in terms of the rules to look at this matter, or is it an issue of Appropriations Committee? And there I think one must just respect the various areas that different committees are dealing with. Because the Auditor General will make a report on this, the report on this report, it certainly will go to the Standing Committee on Public Accounts, Mr. Gordy's committee, or chaired by Mr. Gordy. So one must also keep that in mind. So I'm not going to say whether it was legal or not legal. I think this the Section 16 is clear. I mean, I can go through it if the committee wants, but what must be done, and I would suggest we wait for that report from the Minister, we see to which committee it's referred, and we look at that. If it doesn't come to this committee, I would like to just then advise this committee what is happening, because it has been raised in this committee, so that we all know what is happening and can track it for what it's worth. Thanks, Chair.
Can I raise some issues
before we call on the members? One is, I haven't spoken to you at all about it. Sometimes I do say, look, can you do some work? Partly because for me it's straightforward. If it's outside the PFMA that we pass, then it's just something that's wrong. Oh, MP, do you want to reply first before I say anything? you decided to use Section 16. Why? And, you know, why do you think it was legally sound to do it, etc.?
I don't know if we're going to that detail because we will be in the
speaking to the mic.
It will be in the
from a minister that, according to my calculations, it must be tabled by the 12th of October because it was the amount was authorized on the 28th and it was paid to SAA on the 29th of September, but we count from the 29th. Now, the requirements in Section 16, for me, there are three elements. The one is they say it must be, expenditure must be of exceptional nature. I think there's a number of things you can look at, but unfortunately, the PFMA doesn't tell you. But surely, this is payment to lenders, and there's also payments for the capital requirements of SAA. So the amounts was for those two. And it secondly, it says it must, it's required to, because there will be serious prejudice to the public interest to wait for a normal appropriation. And the last is that, yeah, that is the third part. Now, in terms of the exceptional nature, I explained the second thing, the serious prejudice, and I think we're on record also in the press release from the minister on the 29th of September, that this would have resulted on a trigger on guarantees amounting to more than 16 billion if we didn't meet the requirements from the lenders. The results of that would be quite serious, because that would also trigger a payment from the National Revenue Fund, similar to Section 16. The only difference is that there's no appropriation for that amount, because it's based on the guarantee. And then secondly, on the capital requirements of SAA, that's also indicated we needed that for, if we don't pay, there will be goods and services would not be paid for, and that includes fuel, so it would effectively stop some of the operations of SAA. Now, I think the critical part from my reading from the letter from Mr. Lees is that why didn't we bring an appropriation bill earlier? Now, there were protracted deliberations within government as to how we can recapitalize the SAA, because that was a commitment already made during the budget. And that took a long time to finalize. And then there was also protracted negotiations with lenders, both with Citibank, which is a US lender, as well as with domestic lenders. And that was concluded only very late in September. But therefore, we were required to make this payment, and therefore Section 16 were used. And we will, the minister will submit the report, hopefully we'll make during next week, before the 12th. And just to indicate, the first amount that was paid for started Standard Charter, the 2.2 billion, and the 3 billion now, will be included in the adjustments appropriation bill, because Section 16 also requires must do it within a certain period, 120 days, or if there's an earlier appropriation bill. And there will be an additional proposed appropriation of 4.8 billion, because the total amount that we agreed to was 10 billion for 2017-2018.
Just from my side as a chair, before we throw it open, one is that I didn't speak to Frank. The second thing is the same thing's occurring to me. Where does this go? Thirdly, I think SAA falls under us, but this is an appropriations issue. I imagine the matter will be referred to them. Since Mr. Lees has raised it here, there's no harm in us referring the matter to Pinky Pausa's committee. So I think the first thing we should do is refer it to, even if they're not going to be dealing with it and we are for some reason, they need to be apprised of what's happening. Five is, Mr. Lees, has a similar letter been written by your, just for information, by your colleagues in the Appropriations Committee? You referred it to us because it's SAA. Okay, that's all I need to say for now. I'll give my own views, having heard everybody. So let's have whoever wants to speak from the MP side.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'm not sure that I have a great deal to say. I think Frank's not giving us a firm legal opinion. We've heard from MP the sort of motivation for doing it. I having listened, I'm even more convinced than before that they could have used the normal appropriation processes to get the money allocated, because I really don't think that the drafters of the Act thought that protracted negotiations would form what is, I think, termed the exceptional circumstances. And so I'm even more convinced than before that the process was flawed in that respect. And particularly when it comes to the working capital, where in June we were told they wouldn't have enough working capital to pay suppliers in July, in August, and September. So that was fully known, if one puts the Citibank one. But even the Citibank one was known way in advance. Citibank had indicated very clearly they would not roll over their loan. So to suggest that the protracted negotiations was going to change their minds, well, maybe it would. But the fact is that they were told, whoever was told, whether it's SAA directly or National Treasury, that they wanted their money on the 30th of September. That was a known thing. So I'm afraid I'm more convinced than ever that this the procedure, the use of that section of the Act was flawed. But that's for legal guys to decide, as I think I've said before. I'm not the legal guy. I've got my opinion. I've expressed it. I've asked for a legal opinion. And I think it's we know how. I mean, I'm not in any way trying to reflect on the integrity of any person. That's how law is. It's interpreted differently by different highly qualified people. So please don't think that by saying that I'm more convinced than ever that you made the wrong decision, there's any reflection on your integrity at all. So, Mr. Chairman, what more can I say?
Anybody else have any comments? Derek? All right. Can I raise some quick things? These are thoughts, right? I have to choose my words carefully because he's a journalist here in case I get misunderstood. Firstly, what I want to say, Mr. Lees, is we should separate anticipating. Look, first thing to say is whether it's Pinky's committee or our committee, whoever it is, whichever party, if something is illegal, it's just plain illegal. It can't be done. Nobody can have a policy matter on that. You don't need to convene study groups to say that, right? So, if it is illegal, right? So on that issue, let's be clear. Can we repeat? If something is legally flawed here, then the committee has no choice but to make that clear. And that means it must go to the Speaker's office and so on. So on that one, that's the first point. The second point is, there are two aspects, right? The one is, could Treasury have anticipated this? And I think Mr. Lees is right. It could have anticipated this. There was a reasonable prospect that the money would be required at least from the 1st of October or the last day of September. I agree with Mr. Lees in that regard, especially when you're talking about working capital, as he points out. So I don't think that's the issue. On Citibank, if one read the media, though it's hard to tell from the media, there seemed a reasonable prospect, again, as he says, that wouldn't have been extended, that loan, given also what happened previously with Standard Chartered, was it? Or was it first? Yeah. So then, that too is a reasonable thing. But my own view for what it's worth, right, is that it's not just the negotiations, protracted as you call it, with the Citibank. that mattered and the whole dim prospect that they might agree that you postpone the payback by the end of September. It's also, I think, the cabinet process. Now, you know, Derek will know far more than me, but the whole of July into August, cabinet doesn't meet, right? Secondly, we ourselves are a two-week constituency period, right? Thirdly, quite frankly, if you were to bring an appropriations bill, Mr. Lees, as you know, it should have been brought on the first day, it should have been introduced by the first day of our sittings in August, right? And I think that one also needs to take into account, especially if one considers what the media says, though one can't be sure, that attempts were also made to find other avenues to get the money apart from an appropriations bill. I think it's reasonable to say that PIC was approached and so on. So the decision about whether you go for an appropriations bill or not, presumably, when you're talking of protracted negotiations, I extend that to mean negotiations with other agencies, or the PIC in particular, whoever else, to see if that may be a route, rather than drawing on the National Emergency Fund, right? And for me, at least, Derek, it's understandable, really, that those constraints prevented an appropriations bill. That's my feeling at the moment. Unless I have evidence to the contrary, I mean, Mr. Lees gets cabinet memos these days and so on. Maybe they say something that I don't know. But Derek is much better able to speak to this issue than I am, as a very experienced minister. But I really think, you know, personally, Mr. Lees, if you were in Minister Kikaba's shoes, there would have been all these practical challenges, right? So I'm not so convinced. You see, you're saying that you are more convinced ever now more than before that they should have anticipated it. I don't think we will dispute the anticipation side. What we will question is, does it constitute an emergency or not? You ask, did the drafters meant that? Of course not. No one would have thought we'd be in this situation. It would be impossible for the drafters to have thought of that. Yeah, yeah. They wouldn't have been able, many bills we passed, look at the property rates bill, 350 hours later, right? We still got it wrong here and there. Take the many other bills you spend. You cannot anticipate certain things in Sweden, in Germany, everywhere. So I think that question is helpful and not, because I don't think they could have foreseen you'll have a situation like this. So to ask what do the drafters intend, with due respect, Mr. Lees, I don't think is especially valuable in this context. What we must ask, rather, is given what is there in the law, would this qualify as a case for drawing on the reserve fund? That's the issue, not so much what they intended. My own view at the moment, and it's a very tentative one, is that the consequences of not paying that loan, and I think Mr. Lees knows these things much better than Derek and me, with due respect to that. Okay, me, at least. Would have been disastrous, he knows. So, I do think that, I don't know what the law says, my friend, Advocate Jenkins and MP, I don't know what the law says, but it seems to me, it's a reasonable case for qualifying as an emergency. Whether that is legally sound, what I say or not, I don't know. But that's my personal view, it's not the ANC view, that's my personal view. Then I know we have policy differences, Mr. Lees. And we have every right. Of course, we belong to different parties. And I know that if I was in your shoes, not that I'm saying you're doing this, you're focusing purely on the legal thing, but in the unconscious motivations that the DA might have, it's also that, look, we don't want this money to go to SAA. We'd rather SAA got privatized or SAA got a big equity stake in it. And so on. And those are your policy views, right? Now, you can't win that, not with the current ANC. So, obviously, there is a tendency to look for legal routes to achieve what you might not be able to achieve by policy. And I'll do the same thing, my friend. I'm not saying it's an integrity issue. So, you have to deal with those issues. And I think we should separate the policy issues. Because our gap is not that great. We want a big equity share. I think some of us will argue 49%. You know, we regret that negotiations with that airline got stopped at the last minute, right? When the internet went there. So basically, I think we should separate the policy issue from the legal issue. Finally, I honestly think, Mr. Jenkins, an MP. This is really an appropriations matter. But we should not get territorial. I think we need to send a letter to appropriations. And if need be, Mr. Lees can go to the appropriations committee and one ANC member from this committee can go and deal with it there, rather than now you asking your colleague there to do. But can I plead with you outside this meeting at some stage with Mr. Mania that we, you know, it's fine for you to write this thing to us, but your colleague should also write a similar letter or say CC it to Pinky Pausa, because now I have to refer it to them. This is really, from what I can see, an appropriations matter. But now that it's come here, I don't think we should now let them start. Whatever work you've done, you're going to be the lawyer there. Then I'll hand over to Derek. Remember, I'm speaking for myself at the moment. We don't have a mandated position. But a lot of it, you don't need a mandated position for your party on, because there are legal issues. Yes, Derek?
I'm sure nothing that you said would be...
Into the mic.
Nothing that you said would... be contrary to any policy of the party that you belong to. I just want to agree firstly that it is an appropriation matter. It's not about turf, but a matter has to be dealt with where it is most appropriately dealt with, and that's where it should be dealt with. One, two. You use the term emergency nature, but I think that's quite clear even in Mr. Lee's letter that. It's not about an emergency, it's about, the description here is exceptional nature, but I think... No problem, but in particular, I think in this case, there would have been serious prejudice to the public interest had this not been done. Whatever may be said about what could have been anticipated or not anticipated, if this had not been done, it could have had very serious consequences which would have been prejudicial to the public interest. That's number two. I am a bit more, so I think it had to be done. I don't really question that. I think it was the best thing to do. And so I don't think it serves much purpose to start, examining and scrutinizing the legality of it, because, of course, we don't want anything illegal to be done, but I think it will pass the muster myself, but exactly. And the question is, if we were concerned about the ethics of it, or the desirability of it, and then we would have seriously looked at, well, was it legal? Because we think it was the wrong thing to do, and furthermore, it was illegal. But it was the right thing to do. And so I don't think we need to now start finding ways in which we will demonstrate that it was illegal. I think it's a futile exercise and it's a waste of our time, because it was the right, it was the necessary thing to do, given the circumstances. Number three, I'm a bit more concerned about further transfers to FAA in the absence of a board in which the investors and the public will have confidence. And we've said that many times before, and it's all related to the appointment of the chairperson. I think we don't have to have an ANC study group meeting on that. We know what our position is. We have a position on it. We are very worried about an extension of the 3rd of November date for the AGM and an extension of the term of office of this chairperson, and the very low level of public confidence and investor confidence in FAA given the composition of the board and in particular the chairperson of the board.
All right.
Can I suggest a process issue, right? That we allow Frank to come with a written statement, right, within a week. Was a week enough? You'll confer, right? Secondly, that we confer with the Appropriations Committee from today. Thirdly, that we, Derek, you said things I was going to say. So you've anticipated me a lot. In fact, you put it clearer than I would have. What I wanted to say in a nutshell was, while, I agree with you that we shouldn't now, they have a right, the DA, to pursue this thing to the utmost, and they, I suspect, will. But, what we might want to do is a crude way of saying, let's learn some lessons from this.
Yeah.
Let's actually tell the Treasury, you more than anybody else should know the PFMA and the Moneyballs Act. And we think that although this was an exceptional, the majority, let's say, will accept that it's exceptional, we think it's not desirable what happened. and we would ask you to desist from this. And that, you know, Derek, you prompted something which I have got in my notes that I told you to remind me. I was mandated to just do a two-line, three-line thing about the SAA board chair. Then I said to him, hey, you know what, I haven't had time, but, you know, while we're talking, I'll type something. But now I'm just thinking we can just, because let me tell you something. I've got about 7 calls, right, between the day we spoke with Mr. Lee. No, they released their letters as media statements. They just rehash it, right? Sometimes, although recently I've been getting the letters before they issued. Normally, half the time, you read in the media, journalist phones you, you've got a letter, Mr. Karib. I don't know what letter they're talking about. It's a Monday or a Sunday. Or so. Not Sunday. Usually it's a Monday. Right. But this one, I must admit, Mr. Mania wrote to me on Friday last, although I was in whole day meetings. But this one went to the media also, or maybe people picked it up. And everybody now is asking me, what are the positions you're going to take? I say, I have no mandate. I'm a committee chair. I can't just speak for myself. Let's see what the lawyer says. So maybe what we do is combine the two statements. The clarity I need now, because Derek is saying, I mean, Derek, I think you're saying something slightly different. What we agreed on, can I have it to be clear, that it'll be difficult to have the, no, we agreed that, I was going to look at my notes, am I right, we agreed that it's possible to have an AGM even if it's not a going concern, is that correct?
That's the big question.
Mr. Lee, is that right? You are sure about that? Anybody else wants to comment on that? Can you have an AGM of a state-owned entity that is not an ongoing financial concern, bearing in mind that we're an appropriations bill?
And what test does
it mean? Yeah. Alpha, you're absolutely right about
it.
It was actually conceded by National Treasury.
Oh, right. So can do it.
Yeah.
Okay. Then what I think we should do is repeat what we said, what I was going to do anyway. I was going to draft a statement now and read it out to you, see if you're okay with it. Just to say that the majority in the committee understand the need to capitalize SAA. But we are especially concerned that it's not clear to us and certainly the public out there what are the conditions being attached to this. And then your issue around governance and the board chair thing. So instead of being two different statements, a short statement that summarizes the 5 or 6 points we made here. I'll be careful to say the majority in the committee. It's not something we need to vote on. But I have to say something to them. I don't want to talk to them unless there's a statement. And in fact, I don't want to talk to them, really, because there's too much of time being consumed on radio and so on. So I'll just get you a short statement now with Frank's help, right? Frank, can you help to draft it quickly? Let's send it out. Because I can see now already there's 2 SMSs, right? So are we agreeing on that process? So then what we're going to do is Frank has got 7 days to come back, et cetera, et cetera, and then we can take a decision thereafter in consultation with the Appropriations Committee. You get the broad thrust of the statement. Is it fine?
7 days?
No, he's given 7 days. We agreed. Advocate Jenkins,
he's
consulting to give us a written presentation, and we'll consider it further. Right. Then the next quick thing is, remind me, Alan, we have agreed to write to Jonathan Mint. Remember, for being appointed to the world body. Can you do me a favor? Just send me some notes on that, so I'll draft a letter. Then we also agreed there's one more thing that we have to do. Look, man, in the program we sent you, we've done everything. We've brought in DBSA now. Tell Mr. Mania he can feel warmed because we've got time, right? So we sent you the program that we changed as agreed yesterday. Yeah, that's it for today. And hopefully for, next week we've got our program, right? Okay, so the no, I'll send it out to all of you. Yeah, okay. Justice will help to tie. I'll just dictate something, having got it from you. Right, good. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So, Roy.
There's another little call. Maybe you bring your next call.